Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Wherever you are, this is the Interpreter's Workshop Podcast. I'm Tim Curry, your host. Here we talk everything sign language interpreting. The ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the sideways of interpreting. If you're a student, a new interpreter, experienced interpreter, this is the place for you. If you want to know more, go to interpretersworkshop.com. Let's start talking interpreting.
And now, the quotes of the day. The first by Frank Gehry, Canadian-American designer and architect. Your best work is your expression of yourself. Now, you may not be the greatest at it, but when you do it, you're the only expert. The second quote is by Franklin D. Roosevelt, former American president. There are as many opinions as there are experts. The first quote reminds us that we are and can be good. Have the confidence as an expert interpreter. Do it. And the second quote reminds us to be humble when we do our expertise. In today's episode, it is the last of the interview with Dr. Robin K. Dean. Today we touch on many things and give some insight into research, how we can get more value from our ongoing education, and we expand on some of the ideas from the last episodes. Join me in the final episode with Robin. Let's get started. I'd like to expand on what you were talking about with the first bit of research with VRS, and also, I guess, connected to the K through 12 early years of educational interpreting, you might say. Did you find out how we could change to allow interpreters to have less stress, or at least to get rid of the cortisol, get rid of the stress that is affected by the way VRS is handled in the U.S.?
Well, there's research out there that suggests, how do you reduce cortisol? There's research that shows that something called emotional freedom technique, EFT, which is also tapping. You might have seen people teaching about how you tap on certain points and say certain things that sort of release your body of the stress. And so EFT is shown to reduce cortisol. Again, this is generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Fasting, intermittent fasting is known to reduce cortisol levels. But beyond sort of the general things of which there are, you know, how do we, and that's why Karasik's work is so important. And I'm pulling out his book, the first book that I, you know, read when Bob forced me to look into something other than what I was thinking, and his book, Healthy Work. And it was really quite radical, because basically what he was saying is, yes, you can improve interpreters' health by increasing their controls, but you can also improve their health by decreasing the demands. Mm-hmm. And that's on the employer. And so all of the sort of lunchtime brown bag lectures that you might get at your place of employment about how to meditate or how to, you know, EFT, for example, tapping, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, basically putting all the onus on the employee. But what Karasik was saying in the 1970s, which was quite radical, was, okay, so employers, now what are you going to do on your end of the equation in terms of how do you reduce the demands? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the only thing that is needs to be called into question. I don't doubt that interpreters mm-hmm. could use help with, you know, yoga or meditation. And I'm sure everybody's given those things a try. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the demands are just too much. Mm-hmm. And the nature of the demands, one of the things that we found with this research on caller behavior is that when interpreters reported that this behavior was happening, whatever was, you know, problematic about it, mm-hmm. bordering perhaps on illegal or abusive, is that they didn't know what happened behind the scenes. They reported it, and many of them said, no clue what happened, if anything. And they probably assumed that nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of the kinds of things that can change to make an interpreter feel like they have greater controls, right? They can do something about this demand. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it'll come down to employers reducing the demands of the job. One of the other things that, you know, going back to this topic of exciting, and I 2 years now cooperating with the TERP Academy people and the TERP Academy Summit is that we've offered a pre-conference or graduate student research symposium as a pre-conference to the TERP Academy Summit that happens every year in the summertime. And we've showcased graduate students and their research instead of just the same people presenting, you know, the same, like I keep showing up and it's Robin Dean again, right? And it's nice to be able to say, and here's somebody else, right? And to showcase their research. And I've had a couple of graduate students who helped, who wrote the 2021 publication on this cortisol research, which again, I'm happy to share this article if people are interested. Leslie Caniga and Tiffany Taylor, who looked into why is VRS interpreting more stressful and why is K through 12. And what they found is that, and this has not yet been published, but what they found in their research, I think we did talk a little bit about it in the article, was under the domain of, for VRS interpreters, under the domain of agency, like not feeling like they have agency, not feeling like they can, again, as I said, affect change, right? Do something in response to the job demands. And through K through 12 interpreters, it came down to skill sets and feeling like they don't have the skill sets necessary. And that's not only about language skill sets. That's a little bit broader as well. So long answer to that question. But I think that there's lots from which other researchers can take from the start of our research. So to the cortisol study, if we can say there's a problem, other people can then say, I'm a VRS interpreter, I'll tell you what the problem is, right? And then they'll research to find out if that's the issue. And that's what you really hope as a researcher, that you're not always the one who then takes the next step, but that other people who have more perhaps familiarity with the why it might be, the whys behind the what, we're providing the what. We want other people to find out the whys. And so that's the hope is that people will take that research forward in hopes of making changes from a working condition standpoint.
It sounds like a good reason to get excited about doing research to see where it goes.
Yeah. And to see if the, not that you want to go into research expecting to find what you've hypothesized.
Right.
But you know, if you spent enough time talking to your peers and your colleagues and you get, you think this is a thing. And to see that you get documentation of not only might it be a thing, but here's the color of it. Here's the nuance of it. Here's the texture of it, of that thing that you've experienced. And whether it's working in UMASLI, which I've done for the last 5 or 6 years, well, probably more than that, probably 10 years, or working with my graduate students at the healthcare interpreting program that I teach on, getting them excited about the concept of research and kind of demystifying it, right? Like I said, I did research. I went into research, which I defined then as just having a cup of coffee with a friend and complaining, right? That's a kind of research, right? It's kind of a first step. Am I the only one who thinks this way? You know, and then it goes from there or should go from there.
Yeah. Okay, let's do word association, which is the wonderful part of the episodes where I give you a word or a phrase, and then you give me whatever comes to mind first, whether it's a word, concept, a story, whatever you feel like. And the first, comfort food.
Pizza.
Pizza.
If I could eat more pizza and watch more TV and never write another research article again, I would do that. My brain doesn't allow me to do that, but I would do that.
Yeah. We have to have discipline there. What is that? Sustainable discipline?
No. Subjectivity. Disciplined subjectivity.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. What type of pizza?
Oh, I do not have. I am not a person of an astute and sophisticated palate. So basically, as long as it's cheese and pepperoni, I'm good.
Okay. Next, pet peeve.
Pet peeve. I have one of the, I have really good ears, and people who make noises with their mouths usually, you know, I can't not hear it. And so when I used to be an interpreter and I'd sit next to somebody who just, you know, and I know when I edit video of myself or audio of myself presenting on something, I have to hit the silence audio because I even can't handle listening to my own sort of, whether it's breath. I remember somebody saying, are you afraid that people will find out that you can breathe or that you have to breathe? And it's not that, it's just that I can't handle the sound. And so I have, mm-hmm. Smells are the same way. I have an overly sensitized nose and ears. Certainly the same thing is true about light, et cetera. And so I have a lot of pet peeves around what I can hear and what I can smell. Mm-hmm. And it's my poor nephew who loves to douse himself in cologne. He'll start to come up to hug me and I'll go, nope, I love you. You shower and then I can hug you. So yeah, my pet peeve are people who don't realize that they're making noises and they're smelling. Those are they think good because it's usually cologne or mm-hmm. some other, yeah. you know, yeah. Thing that they add to their body.
So smelly, noisy people. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a pizza delivery boy, I guess.
And then he gets a pass.
Yes. He gets a pass. Okay. Next, heartbreaking.
There's a great quote that I have in my office that says, it's been so long since I've seen it. I want to get it right, which is why I'm stumbling, not because I don't remember what it says, but everybody has a story that would break your heart. And when I'm trying to access an empathetic response, that doesn't mean I'm seeking to feel empathy. Mm-hmm. But if I'm cognitively trying to access an empathetic response to somebody, I try to remember that expression that everybody has, is carrying with them a story that if you knew, it would break your heart.
Yeah. It's a good quote for interpreters to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next, organization.
Something I wish I were. Well, organized, not an organization. I went to a PhD coach when I was in Scotland because I could not figure out how to that's not true. I knew how to fill the time, but the name of her business was Peaceful Productivity. And I was basically chaotic productivity. Organization has never been something that I'm good at. And when I tried to implement productivity or structure or discipline, I fail miserably. I still produce things, but I do so in a way that usually takes a lot out of me, sort of physically and mentally, because I just don't have the capacity to work on something in a discrete way and then say, okay, I've done that now, and then I'll do something else. I'm one of those, you know, it's not that I procrastinate. It's that because I rely a lot on inspiration, it's very messy.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, not good for you, but.
Yeah, it sucks, actually.
Next, culture.
A term that is overused. I think that there is so much about the work that we do that people call culture that if, again, you had a more precision tool or a precision device, you could break whatever it is, whatever phenomena you're seeing and you want to talk about, you could break it up in much more helpful ways if you didn't rely on the standby small c culture. So it's almost like a lazy term in my experience.
Can you give us an example?
Well, usually when interpreters want to reason as to why they took action, they'll call it cultural mediation. But it's not necessarily about culture that you're mediating. If a deaf person that you end up explicating and describing something to make it clearer or understandable or link it to their experience or whatever it is that you're doing, that's not necessarily cultural. That has to do with translation theory, quite honestly. It has to do with communication techniques, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, cultural mediation is one of those terms, kind of like I'm a person first and I'm a member of the team, mm-hmm. that interpreters have just become so used to saying, and it's so much more interesting what they're doing and what they're talking about, and they make it less interesting and sometimes even controversial when they call it what it's not, which is not usually about culture per se. Mm.
Thank you. Okay. The last. Character.
That's interesting. It makes me think of Aristotle's and virtue ethics. And to oversimplify the concept, you know, if you're a good person, you'll do good things. Mm-hmm. And there's also a book that I read, Brooks is his surname, on character and having character. I think I'd rather talk about, again, going back to sort of my seminary education, I'd rather talk about the human condition, mm-hmm. and the human tendency towards anxiety and having an anxious presence than this idea that somehow we kind of develop a character or an aspect of our character, and then it stays like that. It's static. Like I have a character, mm-hmm. you know, I think that we will always be grappling with some kind of fear and anxiety, mm-hmm. which is pretty typical for, you know, again, this idea of the human condition. And I think so instead of using that concept of character, which I've never really found useful in the ways in which I've heard it talked about, I'd much rather engage in conversations about how do you learn to be a non-anxious presence with people. Mm-hmm. And so as an interpreter, anxious, I don't mean anxious, right? And I'm using the sign, the ASL sign for anxious. I don't mean anxious, that restlessness, unsettledness. There's lots of synonyms that are probably better, mm-hmm. but the term that gets used is this idea of non-anxious presence. Again, working to develop and exude a non-anxious presence, both because you have it internally or you've worked to develop it internally for a given moment, but also you know how to act out of that non-anxious presence. One of the exercises I ask my students to do in the graduate program is to research all the different tests and procedures. Well, the common tests and procedures, medical tests and medical procedures that deaf people will, and hearing people obviously too, experience, and to get familiar with them by way of YouTube videos, et cetera. And if you can, even go on an observation where there's no deaf people, but just sort of observe, you know, one of these tests happening, like a spinal tap or a epidural being inserted, or, you know, all the different things that because my experience is that all we have to do is experience something one time, mm-hmm. and that familiarity will allow us to not work so hard to have to exude that non-anxious presence, because we know exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And even though it might be upsetting or disturbing to witness it, we can usually manage those emotions depending on our constitution. We can usually manage those emotions that we know are predictable. It's the being surprised and the unknowing and the on alert, mm-hmm. that can add an additional layer of anxiety to a deaf individual who is already experiencing their own level of anxiety, mm-hmm. Around the test and procedure. So that's an example of how do you build, instead of build character, how do you build a resource of that non-anxious presence?
Mm-hmm. You're talking about stabilizing your own constitution.
Yeah.
Allowing you to have a little bit more stability there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A big thank you to everyone who shares this podcast with a colleague and friend. If you want to support the show even more, check out the show notes for links to buy me a coffee, because it's very embarrassing to fall asleep during an interview. Thank you. Let's go back.
One of the things that you asked me was, you know, what is one of the most misunderstood things about demand control schema? I would like to touch on it because, mm-hmm. you know, it's something as I mentioned, the outcome of this blessing and curse, that it took off very fast in the beginning before it was fully conceived of and formed and written about and all those things and researched, etc. Mm-hmm. One of the problems of that is that people who learned it before, you know, it was at its fullness, if you will, continue to talk about it in ways that are inaccurate sometimes, or just not, you know, missing the mark in some other way. And so that misunderstand, there can be lots of misunderstandings. And one of the examples was, you know, oh, Robin's theory says there's no such thing as a wrong answer. Which obviously is not what we're saying at all. But I think it's important for people to understand the difference between when you're learning something. One of the things that you can do is recognize something that you understand. So go back to elementary school, primary school, when you were learning algebra and the teacher would write up the, you know, algebra equation on the board and solve it. And you'd go, oh yeah, I get it. And you'd get home and then they'd have an equation and you'd go, I can't do it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the distinction between recognizing and producing or reproducing. Mm-hmm. And so in the learning process, lots of people have learned to recognize aspects of demand control schema in that I get it, right? When you do it, right? When you're talking about it, I understand what you mean. Mm-hmm. But if somebody were to say to me, can you explain that? You can't reproduce it, at least in ways that you think reflects accuracy or that mm-hmm. perhaps objectively does not produce accuracy. And so I think that that is a one of the biggest issues that I face is that helping interpreters and educators recognize it's getting to the reproduction place that is necessary for good application and profound change. If you can get to that level. But most people, again, don't seek out educational opportunities at that reproduction level.
And I think that talks to the point of, at least in the USA, those workshops that we're used to having. We go to the workshop, we learn something while we're there, we leave, and then 2 days later, you can kind of remember some comments, but most of the main points that should be applying to your work, to your practice, are gone.
Yeah. And that's normal. I mean, you know, they basically, their brain can only really hold and understand in that reproduction sense a very limited amount and only with repetition. Mm-hmm. If there's information without repetition, it's not learning.
Yeah.
And that's why sometimes the phenomenon of you like experiencing something that you thought was fabulous, a lecture you thought was fabulous. Oh, what was it about? And you're like, well, and there was the, mm-hmm. you know, and then you basically can't articulate it because you're only at the recognition state. There's something inside of you that says that's right. So you know it on some level, on some sort of intuitive level, you know it's right or accurate or reflective or resonating with you, mm-hmm. but then you don't have the ability to reproduce it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only other thing that I would also like to mention is I think we need to let go of the idea that hearing people will ever get it, what it is that we do, and will ever understand deaf people, the deaf community, mm-hmm. signed languages. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. And I think that there was some unspoken promise to us in our educational experiences and even in the flavor of the day that says if you just educate hearing people enough, if you take those opportunities or if the deaf person takes those opportunities to say, well, ASL is a language, or no, I'm not their family friend, I'm a professional intern, all those little things that we say that we hope will stick and then they won't make, you know, quote unquote, the same mistake. Mm-hmm. Other professionals, when they know something that other professionals don't, embrace it and say, this is my expertise. And the fact that you don't understand it only adds value to mm-hmm. my expertise and my understanding and what I do know. And every time you ask me or you say something that we call, oh, stupid, instead of getting annoyed and frustrated, see it as the opportunity for you again, or if you defer to the deaf person, for that individual or for you to be able to demonstrate that expertise mm-hmm. and to wallow in how fabulous it is that you know something mm-hmm. that 99.9% of the population does not know. Mm-hmm. And so that would be sort of my, if It's such a, again, going back to this idea, if we just look through something with a new lens, mm-hmm. if you invite those opportunities, if you hope for those opportunities, mm-hmm. if you wait for those opportunities for a deaf person or for, excuse me, for a hearing person to say, oh, so now are you related or do you also know Braille or all the things that we kvetch about at workshops. Oh, can you believe they said that? What a stupid. Mm-hmm. All of that amplification of negativity is only going to work against you, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to all you have to do is switch it around and say, I have an expertise that most people don't have. And when I have the opportunity to demonstrate that expertise, for most people, that is a rewarding. Mm-hmm. And if you try to switch that off in your brain, often like this idea of watching a television show. I mean, what you wouldn't watch a television drama where everybody did exactly what it is they were supposed to do and everything went just fine. The reason why we become, you know, intrigued and interested in those television dramas that I was talking about earlier is because everything goes wrong. So if we can see ourselves in the front seat of human drama playing out and use these clever mind sets mm-hmm. To see things differently, I think it would go a long way towards allowing us to enjoy our work mm-hmm. and be kinder to people than perhaps is what is sort of the more amplification of negativity that we oftentimes get in the habit of doing.
Yeah. Did you see the other professionals that you work with, Robert Pollard, the lawyer you mentioned with the other research with VRS?
Kate Cerulli.
Mm-hmm. Do they sometimes exhibit those little moments of frustration that we have? They exhibit not knowing or understanding what we do. And have you found yourself
almost emulating?
Yeah.
What I found being a medical interpreter in an employed staff position is that I would often meet the providers in the clinic, you know, behind the scenes in the clinic area. And so oftentimes the deaf person would be called, they go back to their room and I wouldn't engage them until the provider walked in just because of the setup of how things went. Mm-hmm. And so I would often see providers talking to each other in more of that sort of natural gallows humor mm-hmm. sort of. And if you watch old episodes of ER, you'll say somebody say, oh, we've got a bipolar in room two. Of course, all of that is seen as, you know, problematic because we don't want to refer to human beings by their diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the whole point is that that gallows humor or that rawness is notable. But then what I do is I follow that same provider in and he or she is kind and engaged and earnest mm-hmm. and all of those good things. Not that I think that they're pretending or faking it, but they recognize that part of what they do mm-hmm. is part of their practice and their skill set is to deliver interested, invested, empathetic, approach to their practice. And so they embody that, mm-hmm. Even if they're frustrated, even if they think, oh, I know I can't help this person because they're just not going to follow through on the medications that I give them anyway. You know, mm-hmm. even though they express that frustration, perhaps, you know, to themselves or within the confines of their office, when they go in, they're a practitioner. They sort of take that on.
Yeah.
And I think that resilience or that, maybe that's not the best word in this instance, but being able to distinguish between your intrapersonal demands and being able to say, but I'll deal with those at another time in another way within a context that is effective. And right now I need to respond to what's happening interpersonally, mm-hmm. not what's going on intrapersonally. And to see that on display, I think was impactful.
Yeah. Well, Robin, it's been enjoyable to talk to you.
Well, this has been fun.
It's been a lot of fun. So thanks again, Robin.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
What a wonderful way to end the interview with Robin. Let me paraphrase the quote from Robin's office to summarize the meaning of today's episode. We all have a story inside us that is heartbreaking. And we also have stories that are uplifting and happy moments. We should respect people knowing that they have such stories within them. Those are living stories that are with us every day, showing through us, or sometimes are hidden, guiding our footsteps. So let's be respectful and cautious when we're working with others. That allows us
to improve the working conditions for all of us. Discuss with your peers. Share with them your thoughts, your ideas, your worries. Work together. And it might even bring out some new research to help us all. Remember, when you're going into a workshop, going to a conference, a seminar, or maybe even a group supervision, recognize what you're learning, but put it into practice. Learn how to reproduce what you're learning. That will cause us to step up to the next level of understanding, comprehending, and fulfilling that title, expert interpreter. Let's leave with this note. The last point Robin made, let's stop wasting so much energy trying to educate the world about what we do. That's our job. That's why they hire us, because they need an interpreter. If they knew everything about what we do, they wouldn't need us. That's why they pay us the big bucks, because we are experts. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep calm, keep expertly interpreting. I'll see you next week. Take care now.
Well, just as a reminder, I don't talk all that much.
Well, yes. That's what I say. And I have a podcast. Anyway. And I'm an interpreter. Yeah.